The Guardian.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for March the 3rd. Coming up, the drugs don't work, or do they? We'll discuss the controversy behind the claims that Prozac and other antidepressants provide almost no medical benefit whatsoever. Also in the show, to opt in or opt out, we discuss the ethics and politics of organ donation. Plus, we brace ourselves for an invasion of brainless invertebrates. That's not because the Spice Girls are popping by, although that would be quite nice, but we will be telling you about the best science songs of all time. Let's keep those bongos and 80s bass riffs doing their thing for just a little bit longer. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. It's the theme tune that's got everyone talking, with reviews ranging from "it's not rubbish, it's just not as kicking and as immediate as the old one," to "too psychedelic and not enough punch," to "downright terrible." The truth, dearest listener, probably lies somewhere in between. I think it's more Afro-funk myself, and frankly it can't be any worse than the cock rock that we had before. Anyway, who says science isn't glamorous? Your usual presenter, Alok Jha, is in India for the next month trying to prove that, well, everyone does have a book inside them. While this week's pod squad has come from or will be headed to numerous exotic locations. Ian Sample is The Guardian's science correspondent. You're off to French Guiana, aren't you, next week?
I am indeed,
This week, in fact.
Yeah. I've just come back from the Hospital of Tropical Medicine to have my jabs, so I just feel like I've been punched in the arm.
Well, that's not so good. Nell Bowes from Guardian's arts team is no stranger to sailing the seven seas. Any foreign trips?
Possibly, but only to the Isle of Wight. So
I don't know, that's
less glamorous.
And friend of the pod, Andy Lewis from the Quackometer website, has travelled all the way from Cambridge just to be here today.
Oxford? Yeah.
This
I just want to say as well,
wrong.
But I'm a bit disappointed about the theme tune as well. I've only just mastered the old one on Guitar Hero. So a whole new one to change now.
Well, you know, we like to keep you on your toes. It's a great pleasure to have you all here. Right, let's get things going. The biggest science story of the past week was the claim made that Prozac and other antidepressant drugs don't work. The joint study by researchers in the UK, America and Canada examined all available data on the drugs, including results from clinical trials that the manufacturers chose not to publish at the time. When all the data was pulled together, it appeared that patients had improved, but those on placebo improved just as much as those on the drugs. It's created a maelstrom of comment and rebuttal from doctors, patients and psychiatrists. So do the drugs work or is it all in our heads? I spoke to Professor Irvin Kirsch of the University of Hull, one of the report's authors, and asked him how the team dug out the data for the study.
These were the data that the pharmaceutical companies sent to the U.S. regulatory agency, the FDA, in the process of getting their medications licensed. And we used a law called the Freedom of Information Act, through which we were able to get the files from the FDA.
Why do you think it is that pharmaceutical companies, you know, were not releasing these data? I mean, it might look to some on the outside that there might be some deliberate concealment involved.
Well, this used to be standard practice. A company would do a study and then decide whether or not to submit it for publication. And it's true in many fields that some papers, those without significant results, often don't get published in the journals. That's changing now in the drug field. There are clinical trials are now being registered, and I think in the future full data will be available. But in the past, it has not been, and we had to use the Freedom of Information Act in order to get it.
Just thinking from the point of view of some of those test subjects who are involved in those trials, you know, they're arguably taking a bit of a risk with themselves. They're trying an untested medicine, and the bargain that they're making is that they want to make a contribution, I guess, to humanity in a sense, to advance the course of knowledge. And yet, from some of those trials, the data were not being released for everyone to look at. I mean, isn't that a bit of a betrayal?
Well, I don't think that was the only motivation of the participants in the trial for taking part in it. They were also offered the opportunity to get a treatment that may benefit them in their condition. I do think it's important that all the data be published and be made available. So let me be clear about that. And I think it was unfortunate that they were not and that it was so difficult to get a hold of. I especially think it was unfortunate that the FDA decided to not mandate disclosure, even on the labeling of the medications, of the fact that not all of the trials were successful trials. But be that as it may, though, that has been standard practice in the past.
And where do we go from here in terms of prescribing these medicines?
Well, I think they still may have a role to play, but I would hope that more emphasis would be placed on alternative forms of treatment, since I think the most important finding from looking at the data that the pharmaceutical companies produced is that people can get better from depression, they can recover, but they don't necessarily need medication in order to do that. So the medications might be used as something, as perhaps a last resort for people who don't succeed in combating their depression by other means, or for those cases that are very, very severe and for that reason don't manage to benefit from alternative treatment.
Professor Irving Kirsch there at the University of Hull. Now, one thing to say just before we go anywhere else is that if you are on any of these medicines, please don't stop taking them without consulting your doctor. It's very important to get some medical advice before thinking about doing that. And actually, the picture from the study is a little bit more subtle than just they don't work, full stop. Ian, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key finding out of this was that among people with not very severe depression, the drugs were in line with placebo. So the effect of the drug and the placebo were pretty similar. But what happened, which was probably quite interesting among those patients who had severe depression, was that the drugs worked a little bit, but the placebo effect dropped off in measure completely, or certainly a lot. So I think this is a classic case almost of drugs being overprescribed, where they will work for people with severe depression, but they're then given out to everybody who turns up at a GP's surgery saying, I'm down, and people who are basically unhappy rather than depressed.
Andy, the placebo effect, it's probably involved in, you know, every medicine, really. I mean, whenever you go to the doctor, you're getting a placebo effect in a sense. So what does this sort of add, do you think?
I'm not so sure of that, really, in that the placebo isn't a panacea. It's not effective in for every condition you go to your GP about. I mean, there are certain things where feeling good about yourself isn't going to do you any good whatsoever, really. You know, I'm sure we could name all sorts of things, but obviously, depression is one of those things where the placebo does have a strong effect. And in some ways, this study seems to tell us probably what we already knew already or could guess, in that if you're mildly depressed, then going to your doctor and feeling that someone's looking after you and there's some intervention happening means that you're going to feel better. And that if the drugs are having an effect, that's likely to be masked by a general placebo effect.
There certainly have been some studies in the past where they've done sort of smaller meta-analyses and looked at this and found that, you know, on the mild end of things, these aren't very effective. And indeed, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence already have guidelines that say, you know, don't prescribe it for people at the mild end of things. Nell, you've got a comment.
I'm just wondering what the how one kind of goes forwards. What do you do now if you're over-prescribing Prozac, then, and yet you need a placebo of some kind for mild cases of depression? What do you do?
Well, I think that the other options are things like cognitive behavioural therapy. Whether you call that a placebo effect or not, I'm not really sure, but it's an alternative therapy that does seem to work. So I think the NHS have already started saying we want to put more money into that.
Or exercise programmes or things like that.
Yeah. I was just quite interesting because there was a, almost interest in the media reaction to this story, because as we were talking about earlier, about 5 years ago, a senior person at GSK did come out and make the news by saying that about half of drugs don't work anyway. So this it was a really interesting thing to be said at the time, and it made front pages. And so now for a study to basically back that up. And there may be some publication bias in this study. I mean, if you think, I don't know whether they got hold of all of the studies which I mean, obviously, selection bias, you know, the journals will publish the most interesting results, but, you know, do they reject papers that were seen by this group as well? I don't know if they saw all of the pool of studies.
Yeah, there may have been some that never even made it to the FDA, I guess, and they wouldn't have been accessible even to Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there's also another issue which came up at Sokol's, Alan Sokol's talk the other day, where he was just talking about whether there's an ethical dilemma here in whether we should be able to prescribe placebo, because either you are intentionally lying to your patient by saying this will cure you and it has something in it that will do that, i.e. sort of a homeopathy model, or you are so ignorant that you don't actually, you think it will work, but you don't realise that it doesn't work, in which case it's ethically questionable whether you should be in that role anyway. So it's quite a tricky one to know how to move on, I think.
I think there's an interesting question here about good and bad placebos, if you like, whereas, as you're saying, homeopathy is a sugar pill. So anyone prescribed a sugar pill is only going to get a placebo effect, and they've got to believe in the pill. Whereas for these antidepressant drugs, there may well be some sort of action, especially if you're severely depressed. And so I'd class that as an honest placebo or an honest placebo effect, and whether that's ethical or not, I think is a good subject for debate.
Quick comment for me.
Just a very quick one. Ben Goldacre's Bad Science column this week looked at some of the studies looking at placebo effects. And one of the nice ones he found was, a while back, a study was done where people were said, we are going to give you, ill people coming into a GP's surgery were told, we're going to give you a sugar pill. It has absolutely no medicine in it whatsoever. But we know that when we give these to people, some of them improve. Do you want this pill? And of the people who had it, the people who took it, they saw some of them had a notable improvement. So it's a really interesting area. What do you do? And these people were told that it had no medicine in it, and well, still the placebo effect persists. Well. So it's a really interesting psychological.
They didn't believe their doctor, though. That's the thing. They thought they can't be doing that.
Well, if you want an honest placebo, you need one without side effects, without costs associated. Yeah.
But is it a subconscious thing, or is it a conscious response?
Well, let's kick that one into the touch for now. Please do tell us what you think on the matter. Have your say on the blogs at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post a comment on our Facebook wall. I'm James Randerson and this is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, organ donation, science and politics, Holly Toynbee gives us her thought for the pod. Plus,
antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Tom Lehrer with The Elements. We talk about the greatest science songs of all time. And how many of them are there? That's coming up, but first, let's bring in our anti-pseudoscience caped crusader, Andy Lewis, for a second bite at the cherry. For those people who were not listening last time you were on the show, tell us a bit about the Quackometer website and what you do.
I run a website which looks at claims made by websites for health, quackery, pseudoscience, alternative medicine. Most notably, homeopathy is something that I get quite worked up about, as you can well imagine. And the site allows you to type in the URL of a website, and then it goes off and reads that website and tells you whether it thinks it's quackery or not. So it gets me into all sorts of trouble when people find that unfunny.
And some people have found it fairly unfunny recently, haven't they?
Again, yes. A very bizarre situation. It was an ex-doctor by the name of Joseph Obi, who had been struck off by the GMC and has gone on to set up the grandly titled Royal College of Alternative Medicine and given himself the title of professor.
That does sound very important.
He's very important indeed. One of the biggest spokespersons for alternative medicine in the industry, I would say, or so he would like to think anyway. But he got upset because it was when I first started blogging, really, I started just writing about, look, you know, this is quite bizarre how he's using this, and could anyone really actually fall for what he's saying in his websites? And people do. And I've forgotten that I'd written this piece until a few weeks ago, when he complained to my ISP and threatened to sue for £1 million per day.
Blimey. What sort of things was he saying that you were challenging?
Well, it's very difficult to work out what he was saying, really. He writes lots of little pamphlets about how you can cure yourself of cancer and so on. But I don't think anyone really buys them. What he does do is sell letters to other quacks, really, so that they can use the designation RCAM, the Royal College of Alternative Medicine, after their names and make themselves look important too.
What's royal about it? I mean, is that utterly made up?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, utterly made up.
And presumably, don't people come and sue you for using the word royal?
Well,
if you
do that? He's registered companies and colleges and so on in Dublin, where perhaps they're not quite so concerned about that sort of thing anymore.
So what happens next?
Well, it's been a bit of a struggle, really, because my ISP didn't really want to know, and all they saw was a big, frightening letter by someone calling themselves a professor, even though someone has wittedly commented it was like someone robbing a bank in a chicken suit. you know, that was that ridiculous. And they threw me off their web servers, which was not very funny.
Have you got an alternative yet, or is it sort of in the process?
Yes, it's the site's back up and running after a fashion. Ben Goldacre's hosts, actually, the Bad Science blog, emailed me a few months ago when I had similar problems with the Society of Homeopaths and offered to host me. And I rang them up and said, does the offer still stand? And they want to do it for free for a bit of publicity. Positive Internet, they're fantastic. And so with a little bit of technical help, because it's all a bit hard, that stuff, I'm back up and running again now.
Is there anything that listeners out there can sort of do to support the cause or help out? I suppose you're sort of nearly there now. So
not really. It's all blown over, really, I hope. He's still threatening to sue people, but I don't think we're going to hear anything more, really. It's hopefully back up and running, and I'm going to get back on the case of homeopaths before we know it.
Oh, well, go and check out the Quackometer website. More from Andy later. But first, let's get ourselves up to date with the rest of the science news that's been making the headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Nell and Ian with the News Jam.
News Jam. The world's first trial of a fertility treatment designed to be more natural than IVF was launched in Britain last week. The treatment, called in vivo development, aims to take the test tube out of test tube babies by allowing artificially fertilised eggs to grow in the mother's womb.
An acoustic analysis of a recording of the shots that killed Bobby Kennedy on the 5th of June 1968 suggests that there were two gunmen and not one. Senator Kennedy was killed at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles as he celebrated victory in the California Democratic primary. This new forensic research suggests that the man convicted of his killing could not have fired the fatal shots.
The world's ultimate insurance policy against agricultural devastation opened for business last week. The so-called Doomsday Vault on the Arctic island of Svalbard will keep seeds representing the genetic diversity of the world's crops at minus 18 degrees Celsius. The frozen store should keep them safe from war, asteroid strikes and climate change.
And finally, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, scientists in Spain are warning that plagues of jellyfish will return to Mediterranean beaches this summer. They've found 30 colonies of the mauve stinger jellyfish off the Costa Brava, with up to 10 jellyfish per cubic metre of seawater. Yeah.
Thanks, Nell and Ian. Now, I was listening to Ian and Alok's inexpert fumblings with the female G-spot last week, and frankly, I was quite glad I was on the other side of the Atlantic, as I suspect were most of the American population as well. So moving swiftly on to this week's story, Ian, tell us about in vivo development.
Well, can I first thank Mark Gilbert for emailing in with his insight into the Honolulu technique, which I will leave. New to me.
Yes.
Anyway,
please.
It was an education. Anyway, IVD, in vivo development. This is an idea where you obviously at the moment in IVF, you mix sperm with eggs. The eggs fertilize overnight. Usually, you watch them the fertilized egg divide for a few days, and on day five or six or so, you implant it into the uterus. Now, this technique, IVD, in vivo development. As soon as the egg is fertilized, you put it in a little sort of polymer container, a little pouch, basically. It's incredibly thin, and it has loads of perforations in it. And this is inserted into the uterus straight away, and it stays there for the 3 or 4 days that otherwise it would have been in the petri dish for, essentially. So it's in the natural environment, in as much as it's in the body and it's exposed to these hormones and such like that will be going on in the natural situation up to a point. And then after a few days, you have to actually take it out, remove it from this container, and then check that it's okay and that it's divided well and so on, and then actually transplant it back in. So it's being marketed as a more natural form of IVF. But I think there's some interesting aspects about it, and I don't know. It'd be interesting if you have thoughts on it before I tell you mine.
Nell looks like she does have a burning thought.
Well, I'm just wondering, are there any proved disadvantages to the in vitro method?
Well, this is a key point, because you go to fertility conferences and people are always saying, well, we're not too sure if we are very accurately mimicking the situation in the body for the fertilized egg at the very early stages of life. So what they use is a graded growth medium. It varies, and over the days you change the growth medium to try and simulate the conditions actually in the fallopian tube rather than the uterus, and they're different. Now, this system obviously puts the fertilized egg directly into the uterus, where it wouldn't be. It would normally be rolling down the fallopian tube. So it's a different situation, which I think is quite kind of interesting. But I'm also wondering whether this might be almost being sold as something for people who may think natural is good, and almost, you know, maybe there's a gimmicky element to this. I'm not too sure. They've only done a very small pilot study of this in Belgium, and it was on such a small number of people, it's almost impossible to know, to really draw any conclusions. But they did seem to think that the embryos they had developed more quickly and looked very good morphologically, their shape. They looked very healthy and such like. And so they may be better quality, but it's too early yet. You need the trial to find out.
How many people are enrolled in the trial?
Well, for the trial over here, they're only going to have 40 people, but it's part of a multi-centre trial, so it'll be going on across Europe, and then they'll pull all the results by the end of the year. And that will be interesting to see if they can look at, say, is there any difference in birth weight? Do you get heavier babies from this technique? Do you get fewer birth abnormalities from this technique? Because at the moment, it's really hard to know if defects do come about because of the growth medium of IVF, because there is so much manipulation of the gametes and the egg that goes on in that process.
That's fascinating. I was going to ask James another thing about the news jam. Was actually, do you know more about this acoustic analysis of the Bobby Kennedy shots?
Yeah, that was my story from this forensics conference last week. It's weird actually, because it was kind of shades of his brother's assassination, really, because they've been obsessed about that for you know, decades, obviously, and we've had acoustic analyses of the shots there as well. But essentially, there is a recording from a Polish journalist who, without realising it, had his tape recorder running. The analysis tried to work out how many shots there were, and there were 13 in all. There's a lot of noise on the tape, but they reckon there are 13 different shots. And also, there are two pairs of shots that are so close together that it would have been impossible for Sirhan, who is serving life imprisonment at the moment for the murder, to have fired both of those shots using the gun that he was found with. Now, there's no doubt about the fact that Sirhan was there and was firing shots. You know, he was apprehended at the scene, and you know, he pleaded insanity in court and things like that. But what these guys are contending is that there was someone else there with a gun as well, and actually this other person fired the fatal shots.
All hell, the conspiracy theorists.
I know, it's brilliant. Loads of conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Hang on.
Wasn't there lots of witnesses here?
Yeah. There were.
It was in a room, a complex-shaped room with lots of echoes and lots of witnesses as well.
Indeed. Well, I mean, you know, I share your scepticism, but he was, yeah, you're right, he was in the pantry of the hotel, moving between two different rooms, and he was sort of greeting kitchen workers in there, and they were, as you say, it was a very crowded room, lots of people around, and they reckon that someone else had a gun, and in the confusion it was possible for someone else to fire shots at the same time. And they reckon also that, you know, the 13 shots is significant because there were only 8 bullets in Sirhan's gun. So I don't know. Who knows? I suspect it. I suspect it will never ever be sorted out. But it was quite an interesting little tale. Oh, and yeah, Nell, you're looking like you really want to talk about jellyfish.
Jellyfish.
What do you want to tell us about jellyfish?
No, not particularly. I mean, seems to be yet another, oh no, where's the planet going story, and that we've got all these plagues of jellyfish this summer, and they're nothing new, but the cycles seem to be getting shorter, and it seems to be partly overfishing, but also partly human activity and climate change and all the usual suspects.
Well, climate change is one of the reasons for building this freezing vault in the Arctic. And just finally, is there anyone or anything you'd like to consign to history by closing the door on? Sorry, I've sprung that on everyone.
I love everyone, no.
Ian.
It was such a good link, and then we all abandoned it.
And then it all went wrong. Yeah. All right.
I quite like to put sharks in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they're...
Well, cause, well, the thing is, I could argue that I want to do it because they're endangered, but I'm terrified
save them
of
for
them,
the
irrationally terrified of them. And
I'm not sure it's that irrational, actually.
No,
oh,
well,
how
I,
funny.
I really,
sharks
really.
Aren't bad.
No, they are. They try and eat you. and I rather they were in a vault in Norway where I'm not going to be with my surfboard.
Okay, well, just before we move on, anyone who was not wowed by Ian and Alok's knowledge of female anatomy last week might have enjoyed our interview with Professor Alan Sokol, the man who hoaxed postmodern cultural studies types with a fake academic paper. Now, Professor Sokol delivered the Sense About Science annual lecture last week. You can find a link to the full lecture on the blog, but here's a sneak preview.
Now, it's worth looking in a bit of detail at one of the most widely used alternative therapies, namely homeopathy, because its advocates sometimes claim that there is evidence from meta-analyses of clinical trials that homeopathy works. Now, one basic principle in all of science is GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. This principle is particularly important in statistical meta-analysis, because if you have a bunch of methodologically poor studies, each with small sample size, and then subject them to meta-analysis, what can happen is that the systematic biases in each study, if they mostly point in the same direction, can reach statistical significance when the studies are pooled. And this possibility is particularly relevant here because meta-analyses of homeopathy invariably find an inverse correlation between the methodological quality of the study and the observed effectiveness of homeopathy. That is, the sloppiest studies find the strongest evidence in favor of homeopathy. When one restricts attention only to methodologically sound studies, those that include adequate randomization and double blinding, predefined outcome measures, and clear accounting for dropouts, the meta-analyses find no statistically significant effect, whether positive or negative, of homeopathy compared to placebo.
Professor Alan Sokol there. Remember again, if you want to have your say on any of these topics, post a comment on the Facebook wall or head to the Science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Now, the subject of organ donation is always inflammatory, encompassing as it does science, ethics and politics. Last month, Prime Minister Gordon Brown said he wanted a national debate on whether to change the current system of donation here in the UK. So, should people opt in or opt out of leaving their organs to science? Here's Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee with her thought for the pod.
On matters of science and ethics, party politics usually stands back, but not this time. Rather to the surprise of his own party and observers, Gordon Brown suddenly waded into the debate on organs for transplantation and proclaimed he was in favour of changing the present system. No longer would it be for individuals to volunteer their body parts, but it would be presumed everyone consented unless they made the effort to put themselves on a register denying the use of their organs after death. It stirred an instant angry and very political response from Conservative MPs and commentators. Now, they said, Gordon was nationalising citizens' bodies. The state was seizing control of our very selves. No longer just the nanny state, Gordon Brown was turning into the body-snatching state, or so they said. It started a great hoo-ha about the sanctity of the human body. The dead body, it seems, is more valuable to irrational souls than the chance to live a healthy life for the 1,000 people a year who die waiting for a transplant, and the thousands more whose sight will be saved and lives improved by other grafts. The Chief Medical Officer, Sir Liam Donaldson, is strongly advocating this change in the law to put the living before the dead. Quite right, too. Something odd is happening in public attitudes towards not just dead bodies, but bits of dead bodies. It erupted in the outrage of parents of children who died a long time before at Alder Hey Hospital in Liverpool, when they found a rogue pathologist had taken body parts for research without permission. Parents even conducted second funerals. The press took it up as if somehow the children themselves had been harmed by this, as if it were almost murder. So why this obsession with dead bodies in the modern age? Perhaps it's because there's no longer much religious belief that people start to fetishise kidneys or hearts and lungs. Where reason should be replacing the old religions, Instead, it seems that strange, primitive notions take its place. Crystals, aromatherapy, homeopathy, nonsense and non-science of every kind. But when unreason condemns people to death needlessly, Gordon Brown is quite right that the state should intervene. After all, anyone with cranky notions of the peculiar preciousness of their dead body can still opt out.
So, to opt in or to opt out? What do you think, Andy?
I think it's just one more area, as Polly said, where irrationalism and superstition seems to be taking centre stage amongst public debate over very many things. And I think it's a great shame, because what we're talking about at the end of the day is people's lives.
I think you're right. At the end of the day, you know, people who feel very strongly about it can always say no.
Well, absolutely.
So why not? Okay, well, the full text of Polly's monologue is on the Science blog, so you can post your comments there. And there'll be more Thoughts of the Pod coming up in the coming weeks. Now, it's been a pretty heavy issue-led show this week, so how about a bit of music to finish us off? Our friends at Null Hypothesis, that's an online journal of unlikely science, have just put together an online music festival showcasing some of the best unsigned bands in the UK, all of whom have songs with a sciencey theme. It's called Geek Pop, and our very own Science Weekly troubadour, Johnny Berlin, is one of those people performing. Producer Ben spoke to Mark Steer, one of the organisers, to find out more.
Well, Geek Pop 08 was an idea we had to try and showcase the fact that scientists a lot of the time are amazingly creative. They're not just people who sit there in their lab coats in the lab. And we know loads of people who are doing all sorts of crazy things outside of their careers. And so we just decided to put together some music from some friends of ours. But once people found out about it, we ended up getting lots of people interested in sending us in their science-inspired pop. And so we thought we'd put it all together. And we held a little online festival.
Everybody wonders what anaesthetists do while the patient is asleep. Everybody wonders what we do for 3 hours while that machine goes beep.
Tell us about some of the acts that are on there that we can hear.
The Amateur Transplants, who did a very famous rendition of Going Underground by The Jam, but changed to be the London Underground song. They've got one song about the anaesthetist's hymn, it's called. And then also we've got some lesser-known people, but rising stars, one band especially called Let's Tea Party. Their bassist is a biologist, and they're absolutely brilliant.
And now, I interviewed Brian May a couple of months ago and talked to him about kind of the links between science and music. What do you think they are? Why do you think so many scientists are fairly tasty with an instrument?
Well, I mean, it does seem to be the thing that mathematicians especially seem to make very good musicians. And obviously there's quite a lot of links between you know, the timings and making sure you beat, and I think just that general mindset of if you have the right mind, you understand music as you understand maths. It's very natural. But also, I think it's just that scientists tend to be quite creative people and enjoy their music, and it's, you know, enjoy the creativity of it. So I just think it goes on with this that you're permanently thinking. And so even when you're relaxing and listening to music, you're thinking about that as well and getting involved.
Hey there, little lady, how you feeling tonight? I don't know you so well, but you're looking all right. I think we got some chemistry, but maybe not, though. If you're interested, I know a nice little spot where I like to go when things get awfully chaotic, and I want to feel a little more eukaryotic. On the endomembrane system inside of the cell, there's a group...
And finally, this online festival is kind of a celebration of up-and-coming acts or unsigned acts, but if you could have had anyone on there who's written a song that perhaps tenuously linked to science, what would that be? What's your favourite of the sci-pop genre?
Oh, blimey. Well, I'm a big fan of Coldplay, so I suppose the scientist would have to go in there as being, well, I suppose relatively tenuous in its actual lyrics, but the title's quite overt. I think being as that I'm fairly old school, I would probably have to go for Space Oddity by David Bowie. It was one of those that I grew up listening to, and it's an absolute, just absolutely brilliant track. So I think that would be my choice.
Mark Steer there from Null Hypothesis, speaking to producer Ben. The music you heard there was by Amateur Transplant, Let's Tea Party and Professor Science. You can hear those songs in full and the rest of the concert by heading to geekpop08.com. And also, the great Johnny will be in the pod later this month. Now, let me go around the pod one last time. Your best Cy-pop songs. Actually, I'm starting to think maybe there are a few. But Nell, what's your favourite?
Well, I'm going to go non-pop. Is that allowed? I'm going to go Flanders and Swan.
It's a hard enough question to ask, so yeah, no, go for it.
And their song on the first and second law of thermodynamics,
would you like,
which has the great line, "That's Entropy Man."
Ian,
can you just remind me who these people are and what genre of music they sing? I've never heard of them in my life.
You never heard Flanders and Swan? We must get a clip. I'll put a clip on the blog. They're, they're a bit like Tom Lehrer, so similar kind
no,
of...
No, sorry, is it no. folk?
I must confess, no, I'd never heard of them and had to Google
to
them.
To a tune of piano.
Sorry?
It's comedy songs to a piano.
Oh, like Les Dawson?
I wouldn't put them in the same category myself.
One of them looks quite scary with a beard, if that helps.
Genius.
Who doesn't?
I can't believe. I'm shocked and appalled.
Any favourite scientific pop songs, Andy?
Well, I think the collected works of Atomic Kitten, obviously. but actually a little bit more cooler would have to be Blondie with Atomic, of course.
Indeed.
Two Atomic things.
Good shout, actually. Good shout. Yeah. I have my favourite is by one of the finest philosophers in the pop world, Sean Ryder's Black Grape song, In the Name of the Father. And it has this wonderful line in it, Neil Armstrong, astronaut, he's got balls bigger than King Kong. But let me tell you why I like it. Why I like it is that gorillas actually have extraordinarily small testicles because they live in harems. The sperm competition is very low. So compared to chimpanzees, which have testicles like the size of grapefruit, gorillas have very small testicles.
You truly are a massive
love this.
Geek.
Yeah, but King Kong was a big, big
He was
gorilla.
Big. He was big, but relatively, King Kong has small testicles.
He was arbitrarily big.
I think we're getting into G-spot territory here, potentially, so let's wrap that one up there. Thanks very much to Ian Sample, Nell Bowes and Andy Lewis for talking out loud. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or our Facebook page for links to everything we've discussed in today's show. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm James Randerson. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.